Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the declaration of war against Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State, by President Hollande today in a rare joint session of the French Parliament in Versailles. An expert on the French Socialist Party and French politics, Philippe Malier, a professor of French and European politics at University College London and the chair in political science at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, Belgium, joins us. We will look into why so many jihadists seem to come from the Molenbeek neighbourhood of Brussels and discuss the current state of emergency in France and how a war can be conducted against a stateless group whose soldiers that carried out the massacres of innocent civilians in Paris on Friday are born and bred French citizens. Then we'll speak with the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon, David Talbot, about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government, that reveals the dark underside of one of America's most powerful and influential figures. We will discuss how Dulles saw himself above the elected law, manipulating and subverting American presidents, colluding with Nazi war criminals and mafiosi, and based on new evidence that David Talbot has unearthed, playing a much larger role in the assassination of President Kennedy and its subsequent investigation by the Warren Commission. And joining us now is Philippe Malier, who is a professor of French and European politics at the University College London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Malier.
Hello.
And the speech that President Hollande made today at the Palace of Versailles before a joint session, as we would call it here in the United States, the Senate and the Congress, in this case the National Assembly, is a significant event in itself, I take it. But it does feel as though he's declaring war, and his first statements following the massacres on Friday were that Daesh, the so-called self-declared Islamic State, have declared war on France. Now he has reciprocated by effectively declaring war on Daesh. And so what's your response to both the venue, if you will, and the content of today's announcement by the President of France?
Well, first of all, the venue to gather together the two chambers, the equivalent of the Congress and the Senate, or the House of Representatives in the U.S. and the Senate, which is in France the National Assembly and the Senate, was, of course, with a view to giving a very solemn turn to the event, to the fact that, of course, France has been attacked. France is at war, which is a point he had already made on Saturday or on Friday night, and which he reiterated again today. So it's also an attempt to try to unite the whole of the political class, the whole of the political spectrum, from the left to the far right, and to have at least the ability to carry out his policy in the strongest manner possible. So that's what he did. He came to give a speech, which is very unusual. Such meetings do not occur often, say rare. And that's what he did. And he said again what he had said on Friday evening, when just right after the attacks had taken place, which is France is at war. This was an attack. Daesh has declared war to France, and France has to respond accordingly. This is war, and of course, Daesh will be punished in the strongest manner possible by France, which means, of course, deciding on the military option and going where Daesh, the units, the headquarters, the training camps are, that is, in Syria. So that's exactly what he confirmed today.
But, of course, Daesh is a subnational actor, not a state. I mean, they obviously declared themselves a caliphate, but that's aspirational, although they do hold territory. So that's a bit like, I'm afraid, it has echoes of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney declaring war on terror. And of course, terror is an abstraction. It's not a state. It's a tactic, if you will. So are there echoes of that in France, or do you share some of those misgivings?
Well, it very much sounds like it. And probably one ought to explain why he seems to, some 14 years after, seems to espouse and embrace the kind of Bush rhetoric at the very least, and possibly quite soon do what George W. Bush did after 9/11. I think there is, of course, political pressure coming from the right, that is the Sarkozy's party, who aims to run again in 2017 for the presidential election. And, of course, on the far right, a party which is going to from strength to strength, the National Front and Marine Le Pen. So both, of course, have been very vocal and clear about their intentions and what France should do, which is wage war in the strongest possible manner against Daesh. So, of course, there is this pressure. And Hollande, being an extremely unpopular president, being very low in the polls, seems also to have, from his perspective, no other options than simply do that. There is another reason, which is, let's not forget that since he's been in power in 2012, France has been involved in no less than about four wars waged in different places, you know, Afghanistan, Mali, Syria. And really, it's could be said that Hollande, who was seen as a pretty undecisive leader when he was running the Socialist Party a few years ago, seems to be absolutely at ease in his role of chief of the armies. And clearly, I would say that that ideologically speaking, Hollande seems that it's the right thing to do. The only way to get rid of Daesh is to wage war, to send the army to bomb, or, and possibly to send troops on the ground. We don't know yet about that. So it's a mix of both, if you like. And, of course, there is this idea, of course, the French people is under shock, very shocked by what happened. And in those circumstances, of course, this type of reaction seems to go down pretty well, at least for a while, with the public. You know, one needs a strong reaction. One needs to be seen as doing something important. In a way, I'm not too uneasy about him saying that Daesh declared war on France. You know, these were acts of war taking place on French soil. You know, when you have people heavily armed killing in cold blood civilians, this is really an act of war. So it's not really the word, the terminology, which I feel uneasy with. It's more the provisions, what he's aiming to do, what he's going to try to do, because it seems very unclear at this stage what he's going to do. But I think if it's only a kind of sending the troops, bombing, we have precedents, and the precedents of Afghanistan, the precedents of Iraq, and you're better placed than us in France to know that those military interventions were not pretty successful. On the contrary, so this is more, I think, the issue than simply to talk about war. I think, yes, there is war. Now, of course, one can discuss the reasons why France has been attacked. I think France has probably a number of things to reflect upon, is its own attitude or behavior over the past years, strong interventions, the idea that, you know, France has been already bombing Syria, has been involved in Afghanistan, and of course, those interventions haven't been extremely popular. At least they've given a pretext for Daesh and its people to do the killings. This is no way to condemn them, of course, but it's a way to explain that France has been involved herself in military terms abroad, and that's something probably there's very little discussion at the moment in France about that.
And again, I'm speaking with Philippe Mallier, who is a professor of French and European politics at University College London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, and his main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. So President Hollande has also said that he is going to be coming to Washington to meet with U.S. President Barack Obama, and he's going to Russia to meet with Vladimir Putin in the coming days. So he's, I guess, you know, trying to build some kind of coalition, or at least join a coalition, and clearly he's already a part of one. You mentioned the possibility of boots on the ground. I don't know whether that would involve Légion étrangère, the French Foreign Legion, perhaps. That would be a major step. But given that there is, for the want of a better description, a kind of fifth column in France from which most of these assassins came from, I think some of them probably came from Syria, with orders and instructions from the authors of this attack in Raqqa. But most of the foot soldiers were either from Belgium or from France. So how do you translate Hollande's war against Daesh in the streets of Paris? I mean, or in the suburbs, I guess, would be more accurate.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right to stress that a lot of the terrorists who attacked France, and I think I should also make a link with the last January killings in Paris, notably against Charlie Hebdo. I think it's people, youngsters, who were born and bred in France, you know, educated in France. They're French citizens, but for the most part, I think so far, it seems that even the trail led to Brussels. You know, some of the attackers came from Brussels, but in fact, they are French citizens. They were born in France. They just went to live in Brussels. So a lot of them come from France. It's a sort of similar point with the situation of last January. In fact, let's not imagine that those are people coming directly from Syria or Afghanistan. They are youngsters, French youngsters, disaffected. And, of course, this is a major issue. But, again, it seems, and it's totally despairing, that nothing, no lessons have been learned from what happened a few months ago only, in the sense that, at the time, of course, that issue of young French people committing atrocities against other French citizens were brushed under the carpet. There was no real political public debate about that. The few people on the left, sociologists, the usual suspects, as one might say, who dare to challenge a little bit the unity against, you know, the terrorists, and who pointed to the fact that they were, in fact, French people and something had gone wrong with them, notably when you look at their background, where they came from, testimonies from friends and family, normal kids for the most part, who at some point in their life are starting to become criminal, then at some point unemployed, went to Syria and other places and came back as terrorists. So instead of really reflecting upon that and why did France, you know, create such people, of course there was no discussion. I think we're back to square one. I think there won't be, in my opinion, any proper debate about that, because the tone and the priority seems to be to wage war and to try to eliminate physically, military terms, the enemy. So a lot of it has to do with that, you know, how a population, there are about 5 million Muslims in France who on a daily basis, you know, suffer from discrimination, racism. We saw that right after the Charlie Hebdo killings, and I'm afraid we're going to see a lot of it again. There haven't been any ugly scenes yet, but, you know, it's going to be hard for that population. And of course, this is deeply unfair because a huge majority of them have nothing to do with those criminals. To be Muslim is not to adhere to those atrocities. It's a completely perverted interpretation of Islam. It's not even an interpretation of Islam at all. So it's really the lack of maturity in the French debate about that. You know, there are very few voices who are able to articulate that and to be heard. And I think don't expect Hollande or its Prime Minister Manuel Valls to play that role. I think he will be again under pressure from Sarkozy and Le Pen, who are in this respect even worse than him, to say really those are terrorists, part of an international network of Muslim fundamentalists, and they attacked us, so we need to retaliate, and we need to kill them. Basically, that's really the aim. So I think this is really again another similarity with the U.S. reaction back in 2001. There won't be any space to understand why we got there in the first place. I understand, of course, as president, he's got the responsibility of protecting his people. That is, of course, a fair and absolute thing to do. But at the same time, what seems to be missing is really also reflection on waging war, dropping bombs, sending possibly troops on the ground. Is it going to succeed? Is it going to do any good in the long run? There is the U.S.-British precedent in Iraq. I beg to differ, of course, there will be a lot of things to be done diplomatically. The irony is also, some people have started in France to point at the hypocrisy of Hollande and his government and the previous government, who've been doing very good business with some countries in the Middle East. Notably the Emirates, the United Emirates, and Qatar, selling them weapons, arms, and we know very well the roles played by those countries and also in supporting Daesh. So there's a lot of things, questions and unanswered, and I think for the time being, of course, there's unity. People are under shock, they're mourning. But again, I expect that within the next few weeks, I think things will become a bit more clear that the sort of decision taken by Hollande today might not be the right one.
Well, he's operating and his law enforcement forces are operating under a special emergency order, which I understand can only last for 12 days. And in order to extend the state of emergency, there would have to be a vote to alter the Constitution, I believe. So what are the mechanics involved in this current state of emergency where the police are free to round up whoever they want, and they apparently are rounding up at least, I think, 250 people or so far. So what's your sense of the legal umbrella, if you will, under which this state of emergency is operating?
So as you rightly stated, the state of emergency is for 12 days, so started yesterday. In fact, it started as early as Saturday, of course. It will be extended. Parliament will grant that extension, I think. I can't see anyone voting again that extension. And, of course, that extension could be for months. I think the Prime Minister was even already talking before that extension was given to the government of a period of 5 to 6 months, which is a very long period. In fact, what will happen is a drastic, dramatic reduction, limitation in civic liberties, limitation in meetings in public places, the number of people, and I think the law is very strict. The meeting is when at least two people gather together in a public space. So, of course, yes, the police will have the right really to use that, and the government as well to use that to ban some meetings, some gatherings, including some political meetings. And that creates a very strange situation because France is, by the way, in a period of was in the middle of an electoral campaign for the regional elections taking place in early December, so that the campaign was suspended. which is fair enough after that. So now the question is, we understand tonight that it will start again tomorrow. But that's very strange. You know, that's a state of emergency with a campaign and a vote taking place in 3 weeks' time, with severe limitation to civic liberties. That includes also what some groups, political parties, opponents to the government might be able to say and express in terms of, you know, criticizing the power for what it does. This is pretty unclear. We'll see. Again, it's a bit like the president addressing the two chambers in the Versailles chateau. It is very unusual and rare to use that power of emergency. It was used only a few times since de Gaulle's return to power in 1958. So that shows again how exceptional the decision is.
Let's just take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and continuing the conversation with Philippe Malliere.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
The dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Philippe Malliere. Since you clearly also work in Belgium, tell us about the Molenbeek neighborhood in Brussels that has apparently these characters that they're looking for, and that the brothers that were killed in the attacks, they blew themselves up, and I think one of them was shot by the police. But the ones that perpetrated these massacres apparently live quite close to this mosque. It's very identifiable. And you say, and you mentioned they were French and they moved to Belgium. So why is Belgium all of a sudden the hotbed? And you know, the attacks that was thwarted on the train by the three young Americans, that was being launched out of Belgium, I understand, and a number of atrocities have been launched out of Belgium. So why Belgium?
Why Belgium? To be fair, the hubs of terrorists are a bit all over the place in Europe today. It is pretty well known by intelligence, by anyone working on the subject, that France is, of course, the very center, the epicenter of it, because of the sheer size of populations, the greatest Muslim population in Europe by far. It also has the greatest Jewish and Armenian population in Europe by far. So it combines those three populations in excess of any other country in Europe. So that's why a lot of it, France has become a chief target for Daesh, plus the fact that France is officially not a Christian or religion isn't part of the state. It's a secular country. It's called laïcité in French, which where the state and religions are totally separate. So for all these reasons, of course, Daesh doesn't like France, plus the more recent interventions. Now for Molenbeek. Molenbeek is a popular, I should say, working class suburbs of Brussels, in which over the past 20, 30 years, a Muslim population has come to live. It is, again, a popular, buoyant, vibrant working-class area when you visit, but it has also lately become a place where a number of Muslim fundamentalists have gathered in a sort and in a kind of a fairly free manner. Of course, it remains to be seen now what the Belgian police has made some arrests since Saturday. And I think that's what's going to happen. We might see some further development in Europe because, you know, there are also other places. Italy, Germany are also places where it is known that there is a Muslim population and some of them have made some journey to Syria, have come back. But the whole issue is that, you know, in a democracy, you can't arrest and put in jail anyone going to a place which is not your liking as long as they haven't broken the law. So what intelligence is trying to do, of course, is monitor those people, which is hard. Sometimes the police doesn't have the means to really actually do the job well. Monitor some, then they lose their trace. You know, it is difficult, and I on that the police can't totally be blamed. I think it's a question really for Belgium. In short, is just one center. You know, it's not that every it's become a kind of hub or the heart of Muslim fundamentalists in Europe. They are the places. That's why it makes the subjects, the situation extremely volatile and complex for European policies. Britain, where I live myself, London notably, is another place also where now you can feel the British government also is extremely worrying suddenly. Things could happen also in Britain, and things have happened already back in 2005, as you may remember, with the bombings. So it's a volatile situation. What is really striking, and I think probably for an American audience that will sounds strange and worrying, is that there was a sense of fatality almost when it happened. People were horrified, were also certainly shocked at the extent of the massacres, but a lot of people were saying, including people who narrowly escaped death on Friday evening, that it was bound to happen. People kind of expected it, which shows again how hard the situation, how complex and how serious the situation is in Europe now.
Well, but clearly the guns, the Kalashnikovs, the AK-47s that were used are a factor. Now, here in the United States, we're hardly in a position to lecture anybody about the proliferation of weapons. And I understand that in France and in Europe and in the UK, there's a tremendous amount of gun control and restrictions compared to the United States, where, thanks to the National Rifle Association and their powerful lobbying in Congress, we have the best armed criminals and, by extension, terrorists in the world. And even in Al-Qaeda's own playbook that was found when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, they found the manual, if you will, from Al-Qaeda in it, and they instructed their jihadis, if you go to the United States, don't bring the weapons with you. You can buy them off the shelf there, you know. So that's the situation we have here in the United States, but it's very different in Europe. And these guns, these AK-47s, again, came from Belgium, and so did the AK-47 that the would-be terrorist had on the train recently, who was subdued by the three young Americans and the British gentleman. So is there anything about Belgium in terms of having ready access, or is there a black market for Kalashnikovs?
It's clearly a question of black market, because, as you said, there is gun control in Europe, and rightly so, because for us Europeans, of course, it's not by making a gun buying guns and owning guns and making that free and accessible to all. It's going to sort the issue. I think there are, of course, more dramatic developments when it comes to violence due to weaponry in the U.S. than here. Just a case, for instance, of the repeated violent crimes committed in school areas or universities. That doesn't happen. That hasn't happened yet, at least in Europe, fortunately. So, no, the situation isn't as bad when it comes to, in fact, violence due to guns or weapons in Europe. It's just they are clearly a black market, and people who are extremely determined to smuggle through those weapons in Europe, the heart of Europe, Belgium, Yes, Belgium seems to be a place where things seems to arrive and later are dispatched to. I can't explain why. I'm not a specialist enough of that issue to explain how they get there. And I suppose if the police knew it very well, they would do something about it. But at least, yes, there is a black market, and I think there's circulation of guns in Kalashnikov, explosives in Europe, because it seems that the striking feature of that attack, it was well-coordinated, it was professional, it was cold-blood killings, those people were ready, and they were... they had the proper weapons to do that. It wasn't a matterish in the least. That's why the number of casualties is so high.
Well, presumably that is an area where at least the law enforcement authorities can increase their activities in terms of interdicting arms. As I say, in this country, it's impossible to do anything about it after the massacre of the school children in Connecticut, when the president was so upset and went live on television. They couldn't even get a vote in the Congress.
Mm-hmm. So, the relaxation of gun control is an absolute non-starter in Europe. There wouldn't be any politician from the left to the far right to advocate such move. Absolutely a non-starter. So on that, the US and Europe are extremely different. We're really poles apart. There is no lobby in Europe to push forward that kind of legislation. And on the contrary, what people and politicians in Europe would say, well, thanks God we have guns imitation, because otherwise things would be far worse. That would be the sort of standard reaction, if you like. So there is no chance, if you like, of a situation of a kind of US-style evolution, if you like, whereby in order to protect its citizens, a government or a state would suddenly relax gun control and would let people have guns at home in order to protect themselves. It is absolutely a non-starter, and no one would advocate such thing.
Well, Philippe Mallier, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at the University College in London. In 2007, he was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, and his main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon, David Talbot, about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government.
We've all seen enough now. It's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God damn it, things fall apart. I'm more important in the U.S.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Talbot, who is the author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He is the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and was a senior editor at Mother Jones. His latest book just out is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Talbot.
Thank you, Ian.
And when Harry Truman signed the National Security Act of 1947, he worried aloud to his aides. He said, "I hope I'm not creating an American Gestapo." And 15 years later, Harry Truman wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, just 1 month after the assassination of President Kennedy, in which he lamented about the state of the CIA and said, basically warned that, I'm just looking for the quote here, that...
That we were in danger not only of imperiling democracy overseas with the creation of the CIA, but that Truman had come to believe by 1963 that we were actually endangering democracy at home as well.
Indeed, and he warned about that also in a letter to a friend. So what's your sense then of that connection to the event that had just taken place a month earlier in Dallas?
Well, I think it was very telling that it came on the heels of this terrible tragedy in Dallas in November 1963, the killing of the president, and the fact that another former president who had created the CIA, as you say, in 1947, was now, just weeks after the trauma of Dallas, warning the American people that the CIA might be out of control. Certainly, it caused a tempest within political and media circles. A number of columnists around the country responded and voiced their own concerns about this national security state that seemed to grow out of control. And in fact, Alan Dulles, who, of course, had run the CIA through much of the Cold War, was very alarmed by this for political reasons, and he tried to pressure Truman into retracting the piece, even flew down to Independence, Missouri, where Truman was retired, to personally sort of twist his arm. But to no avail. Truman was a stubborn, famously so, character and stood by his article. So what Dulles did was the next best thing. Of course, this is common practice in the intelligence world. If you can't change reality, you change the record. And he wrote a letter to the chief counsel for the CIA, Dulles, explaining that Truman basically was senile and that he didn't know what he was writing, and he had sort of set him straight when he went down to Missouri, all of which, of course, was a lie.
Well, in his letter to his friend a year later, he said, the CIA was set up by me for the sole purpose of getting all the available information to the president. It was not intended to operate as an international agency engaged in strange activities.
Strange indeed, yes.
So what happened in that intervening 15 years then between 1947 and the assassination of JFK?
Well, Truman felt that under Eisenhower, the CIA had gone rogue and had pretty much been enabled to do whatever it felt like, overthrow governments, spy on the American people, assassinate leaders at will. And he felt that Eisenhower didn't have his hand really on the wheel of the government, that he had basically subcontracted foreign policy during his presidency to the Dulles brothers, not just Alan Dulles of the CIA, but to John Foster Dulles, his older brother, who, of course, was Secretary of State under Eisenhower. So it was a remarkable, actually, brotherly duo. And, part of what C. Wright Mills, the sociologist, the great sociologist of his day, called the power elite, what scholars like Peter Dale Scott and others might call today the deep state, and these were the people who essentially ran American power on Wall Street in various national security positions. They were all members of similar organizations and clubs like the Council on Foreign Relations, where they worked out policy before it was implemented in Washington. These are the people who pretty much ran the show, no matter who was elected president, and that certainly was the case during the Dulles era.
Well, you write in your book, which starts, with Dallas's early life and all the way through his service with the OSS in Switzerland, and then through the period of when he was the head of the CIA, the first head, the longest serving head, and we've had something of a revolving door of late with the CIA directors. By the way, all of them are appearing on a Showtime documentary, which I haven't seen, but it sort of smacks of being somewhat self-serving. But I'll reserve my opinions until I see it. But what The book really it gets into in a way that's very surprising, is the extent to which you suggest that Dulles had had a much greater role in the assassination of JFK than previously reported. And you say, over the final months of JFK's presidency, a clear consensus took shape within America's deep state. Kennedy was a national security threat. For the good of the country, he must be removed. And Dulles was the only man with the stature, connections, and decisive will to make something of that enormity happen. He had already assembled a killing machine to operate overseas. Now he prepared to bring it home to Dulles. So elaborate, if you will.
Yeah, well, look, Ian, it's no secret, of course, for people of my generation, I'm 64, people who grew up after World War II, through the Cold War and now the War on Terror, that there's been an epic struggle within this country between the forces of national security and secrecy and permanent war and the forces of democracy. And in fact, it's been a rather one-sided struggle in the last few decades. President Kennedy was, I think, the only president in my lifetime who seriously challenged the power of the national security state. It's what Eisenhower, as he left the White House, of course, conveniently, warned us about, the military-industrial complex and so on. And so JFK realized, I think, he'd made a mistake by keeping Dulles on as CIA director. He has the calamity of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba that the CIA organized. And I think the plan there all along was to sandbag Kennedy into launching an all-out U.S. military invasion of Cuba, which he refuses to do. And that precipitates, I think, a very bitter split within the Kennedy government between the White House that is increasingly looking for ways to defuse this terrifying hair-trigger nuclear situation, and, you know, start to resolve the Cold War with the Soviet Union and with Castro in Cuba. And that's Kennedy on the one hand, while his national security state, the people in the CIA and the Pentagon, are, you know, completely focused on a much more hardline solution. In fact, there are generals in the Pentagon, like Curtis LeMay, the head of the Air Force, who actually wanted a nuclear confrontation. He thought we could take out the Soviet Union and achieve nuclear victory. Kennedy thought he was mad. So this was the kind of building tensions within the Kennedy administration. He fires Dulles after the Bay of Pigs disaster. And by the way, that same week that he's trying to overthrow Castro in Cuba, Dulles apparently is behind a coup attempt to overthrow an ally, President Charles de Gaulle, in France. Kennedy knew nothing about this until it suddenly exploded in the press. And suddenly he has the French ambassador in the White House demanding to know what's going on. And Kennedy is put in the extremely awkward position of assuring the French ambassador that while he himself is not supporting this attempted coup to overthrow de Gaulle, he can't speak for his own CIA. He's not in control of his own government. So this was the kind of high-stakes drama that was happening throughout the Kennedy presidency. And again, the CIA was subverting his policy, going around his back, trying to countermand what he was doing in the way of, you know, defusing the Cold War. And even after Dulles is fired, he goes home to Georgetown, and he continues to operate as if he's still the CIA chief. He meets with his top deputies. He advocates policies that are in opposition to Kennedy. So he essentially sets up a kind of anti-Kennedy government in exile. And I believe that the assassination team that Dulles built to kill foreign leaders like Patrice Lumumba in Congo, like Fidel Castro and others, was essentially brought home to Dulles in November 1963 to kill this president who they felt was a threat to their national security operation. And I have new evidence that I present in the book, including, I think, a very key piece of evidence, which is the fact that William Harvey, who was the head of Dulles' CIA assassination team, by the testimony of Harvey's own deputy, was indeed in Dulles in November 63 before the assassination. He was stationed in Rome at the time, Harvey. He had no business being in Dulles then, and yet that's where he's identified as going.
And again, I'm speaking with David Talbot, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He's the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and was a senior editor at Mother Jones. And his latest book just out is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And he will be speaking about his new book and signing copies at a KPFK-sponsored event at the Peace Center, which is at 3916 Sepulveda Boulevard near Venice Boulevard in the 405 in Culver City, on Tuesday. That's tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. So it's extraordinary then, given what you've just told us, that Alan Dulles, the man who was fired by President Kennedy under bitter circumstances, and at the time, that was 85 days into Kennedy's presidency, that the Bay of Pigs happened. He was blindsided and made that famous remark about, you know, failure being an orphan. But he vowed privately to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and clearly that didn't happen. But the idea that the man who Kennedy had fired under these circumstances came to oversee the investigation into his murder has always been a massive mystery to me. What's your explanation?
Well, it's a stunning coincidence, and I put coincidence in quotes. It's the classic case of the fox investigating who killed the hens. You know, it was Lyndon Johnson later tried to claim that it was Robert Kennedy, of all people, who urged him to place Dulles on the commission, which was in keeping with, a president who was famously deceitful. One other lie that Lyndon Johnson told. But the truth is that Dulles himself and his top CIA deputies lobbied heavily to get Dulles on the commission, and that once he was on the commission, he was such a dominant figure. You know, he was the only one who didn't have a day job. The others, like Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, of course, was running the court. But Dulles was supposedly retired then, had nothing else to do, so he utterly devoted himself to the commission, and some people thought he dominated to the extent it should have been.
Hello? Did we lose you? It looks like we lost that call. Trying to get him back on the line here. Just continuing, we just lost you there.
Yeah, so, I mean, his basic, the thrust of what his service there was to misdirect the commission to focus entirely on Lee Harvey Oswald as the foregone conclusion, the lone nut, the lone assassin. And any kind of evidence that connected Oswald in any ways to U.S. intelligence or that looked into any other possibility of a conspiracy was quickly stifled by Dulles. And so that was indeed the conclusion, even though, of course, a mountain of evidence pointed in other directions, including the fact that one of the own commission members, Senator Richard Russell, thought that there were others behind Oswald. So, and Oswald himself, of course, before he was silenced, famously yelled out to the press, "I'm a patsy." Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General, and others quickly determined that there was indeed a conspiracy. He figured out that Jack Ruby, who of course shot Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of the Dallas police station, was essentially a mafia errand boy. Bobby had been told, of course, that the CIA was using the mafia to do its dirty work, and had found out about the CIA mafia plot to kill Castro. And so Bobby Kennedy, who was one of probably the top investigators in America when it came to looking at the dark corners of organized crime and American power, quickly, I think, put together the fact that this was a conspiracy that had grown out of the CIA and had grown out of the CIA's assassination plot against Fidel Castro, and that assassination team had been turned against his brother instead in Dallas.
So what did why didn't RFK go public then, if he knew, had this knowledge?
RFK was losing power as Attorney General by the hour as soon as Lyndon Johnson was inaugurated. He and Lyndon Johnson were famously, of course, bitter enemies. J. Edgar Hoover was another bitter enemy of Kennedy, and it was Hoover's FBI that was in charge of doing the legwork for the Warren Commission during the investigation. Hoover was so bitter an enemy of RFK that he wouldn't even return his phone calls as Attorney General, even though as Attorney General, Bobby Kennedy oversaw the FBI. So Bobby understood that he had diminishing power and was intent later on in getting back to the White House as president and was confiding in various people who were close to him that he would indeed reopen the case.
Right. Well, I know that LBJ always claimed that Castro was behind the assassination, and you know that, of course, that Desmond Fitzgerald headed up the team that was looking into the assassination, and there was a walk-in at the CIA station. Fitzgerald was CIA station chief in Paris. There was a walk-in from the DGI, the Cuban intelligence, a guy called Major Cabela, who they gave the assassination tools, all of which are in a museum down in Havana, and they apparently kept asking, you know, who's issuing the orders? They wanted to know, and eventually it was stated that it was from the very top. So walk us through that notion that on the one hand, you know, after saying he wanted to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces, JFK apparently did go after Castro. And if LBJ is to be believed, Castro was the one person on the planet who had the most reason to go after the guy who was trying to kill him. So walk us through that, if you will.
Well, that, of course, that's a big if LBJ is to be believed, because he was one of the most deceitful men who ever occupied the Oval Office. No, I think, you know, the proof is there among all the people I interviewed for not only this book, but my other earlier book about the Kennedy presidency, Brothers, that Bobby was genuine. When he heard from the CIA in May of 62 that, oh, by the way, we have, developed a plot with the mafia to kill Castro, Bobby was furious. He was a known enemy of organized crime. He was a mafia hunter for many years. He'd come into public life. That's how he made his name. So he was furious to hear that this top intelligence agency was now in bed with the mafia trying to kill Castro. He thought he'd pull the plug on it. But in fact, even as the CIA was telling him in May 62, oh, you know, we've ended this alliance with the mafia, they were indeed handing over poison pills, William Harvey, this man I talked about earlier, to his mafia counterparts to kill Fidel. So again, the CIA lied consistently to Kennedy's, and one of the lies they told was that they had ended this mafia plot to kill Castro. In fact, you know, this guy Jim Donovan, who's played by Tom Hanks in the current Steven Spielberg movie Bridge of Spies, who was this kind of heroic citizen diplomat who helped bring back the downed U-2 pilot in Berlin, Francis Gary Powers, and then is tapped by JFK to go to Havana and to open up peace negotiations with Fidel, which results in the freeing of the 1,100 Bay of Pigs prisoners. And then Kennedy says, go back down there and try and widen this peace into a lasting peace with Cuba. Decades, of course, before Obama did that. And so Jim Donovan goes down there. He and Fidel hit it off. They both like to talk. They like to drink late into the night. And he's making real progress. And the CIA hears about this. And they come to Donovan before he's about to leave on another trip to Cuba. And they say, hey, we hear Castro likes to go scuba diving. Why don't you give him this gift, the wetsuit, so he can use it to go diving? And it turns out, of course, according to the Church Committee, later on, we find out that this wetsuit has been poisoned. And it's yet one more attempt to kill Castro. So imagine the cynicism of this, using a JFK peace emissary to Cuba, Jim Donovan, to try and kill Castro. And, of course, the very day that JFK is killed in Dallas, Fidel is meeting with another peace emissary from Kennedy, the French journalist Jean Daniel, who's carrying an olive branch from the Kennedy White House. And Castro is dumbfounded and deeply dismayed by the news from Dallas. And he says, now it's all over, meaning, you know, the peace attempts, the negotiation. And he says, well, now wait, they're going to pin this on me. And, of course, that's what they hear. The next broadcast from the U.S. is a broadcast tying Lee Harvey Oswald to Cuba through the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. So, no, this was, I think, Kennedy opened a peace track to Havana that that was in direct defiance of the CIA's hard line. And the CIA basically defied Kennedy by continuing to try to kill Castro.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the other person who was a key to the Oswald situation, he was his CIA handler, this white Russian, Morishield. He, along with Oswald himself, who said, "I'm a patsy," he ended up, even though he testified to the opposite before the Warren Commission, he ended up apparently feeling that he was a patsy too. He was used. So what did Castro's handler really believe happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one more coincidence, so-called, that ties Dulles to the JFK killing and to Dulles. George Morenschild was one of Oswald's babysitters in Dulles. Oswald, after defecting to the Soviet Union and denouncing the United States and proclaiming that he's going to hand over military secrets to Russia, he's allowed to come back in the United States with surprising ease. He clearly is playing some kind of intelligence role. He comes back to Dulles, and one of the people who kind of, you know, keeps an eye on him is this guy, as you mentioned, George Morenschild, who's a white Russian emigre who's kind of tied into oil industry circles and intelligence circles. His brother, in fact, worked for the CIA. He was an anti-Soviet scholar. And, you know, Morenschild would travel around the world on so-called oil business and then be debriefed by the CIA whenever he came home. So Morenschild knew Dulles. Dulles was very aware of Morenschild's brother. It's just one more sort of connection between Dulles and the events in Dulles. You know, and why is this all important, Ian, at this point? I mean, to be dredging this history up, because what's past is prologue. And my contention is that by not getting control of the security state, by allowing it to run amok, not only overseas but at home, you know, that's why we're having to deal with the current sort of permanent state of fear and terror and war throughout the world, that the American people have been shut out of the democratic process. We are, you know, as C. Wright Mills put it, talking about people like Dulles, such men as these are crackpot realists. In the name of realism, they've created a paranoid fantasy all their own. And, of course, we're forced to live in this paranoid fantasy where there's one act of violence brings on a whole new round of reprisal and more surveillance and more repression and on and on and on. And we've been living this now through the Cold War and the War on Terror. And, you know, either we're going to decide that we have a democracy where we begin to intervene in this process, or we just, call it quits.
Well, David Talbot, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Talbot, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He's the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and was a senior editor at Mother Jones. And his latest book just out is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.